Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to this special report from Unheard. In the past few weeks, it seems like every few days there's a new general or defence secretary standing up to talk about mobilisation of troops, about the possibility of World War III, the impending disaster of a Trump presidency, Europe's vulnerability, and so on. It started with a leak to the German newspaper Bild from the Bundeswehr describing something called Alliance Defence 2025, which was a scenario planning for a NATO-Russian war in 2025. Then, the following week, a man called Rob Bauer, a senior admiral and chief of Defence Military Committee, described the need for a war-fighting transformation of NATO, which once again hit front pages across Europe. Then it was the UK's turn. The Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps, said that he thought war in the next 5 years was a possibility, which was quickly followed by Sir Patrick Sanders, who is head of the army, who made front pages across the UK by describing his ideas about conscription and mobilisation, the need for a quote-unquote citizen army to engage in wars. So what is going on? Is this the quote-unquote military-industrial complex doing their usual thing of lobbying for more money from governments? Is this exaggerated hysteria about a potential Donald Trump victory, a kind of European mass crisis moment where we're going to be abandoned by the Americans? Or is it real? Is there something to it, and do we need to take it seriously? We wanted to find out, so we've brought together some different views to try and get to the bottom of it. We've got three people joining us today. The first is Aris Roussinos, our very own foreign affairs editor here at Unheard, who's done this special report. By the way, you can find the full report on unheard.com. I highly recommend it. He's going to outline the situation from his perspective. We're then joined by a man called Elbridge Colby, who we've actually had on the show before. He's a bit different because he's actually quite likely to be at the centre of a future Republican administration, if indeed the Republicans win. He could be calling the shots on what American foreign policy actually looks like, so I'm excited to see what he has to say. And then finally, we're going to hear from Pippa Malmgren. She is a geopolitical strategist, a best-selling writer. She is the daughter, in fact, of Harold Malmgren, who himself was an advisor to a series of presidents from JFK onwards. She is an expert on particularly those kind of fronts that you don't hear about so often that aren't on the front pages of the papers. And I think she will give a slightly different take. So let's begin with Aris Roussinos. I started by asking Aris Roussinos to lay out the facts for us. What kind of army or military resources does the UK even have anymore? And how useful would it be in a world war?
The Navy's under strength, everyone knows. The Royal Air Force is probably too small for the task. But both the Navy and the Air Force are in much better shape than the Army. The Army is absolutely the weak link in British defence.
So numbers-wise, am I right in saying we had around 700,000 in the 50s and we now have something closer to 70,000 troops?
Yeah, so by 2025, we're moving to about 73,000. So to put that in context, just in the Battle of Avdiivka, which is ongoing in eastern Ukraine, a small town, about 30,000 people, the Russians have got 40,000 troops deployed just to take that town.
And haven't actually managed?
No, they haven't.
So we potentially have the army you would need to conquer a medium-sized town?
With some effort, yeah. Obviously, Britain wouldn't be fighting alone. We should assume that the Americans wouldn't be taking a significant role in proceedings. Britain wouldn't be fighting alone, be fighting alongside the Poles, be fighting alongside the Baltic countries. And also, it would be defending rather than attacking. So it has that stats in its favour, but the situation is not good. The British, quite frankly, the British Army is not prepared for war with Russia. If you look at the war in Ukraine just over the past 2 years, the expenditure of artillery munitions has been way above what NATO planners had planned for and have stockpiled for. So, you know, a few months ago when the US gave Ukraine, you know, then controversial cluster munitions, that was because it had basically run out of conventional artillery shells. So that was necessary to keep Ukraine in the fight. The sheer amount of artillery munitions being expended in Ukraine is, you know, is mind-boggling. European countries haven't stepped up production.
Do we produce shells in Europe?
We do, not enough, I think.
Where? Where do we produce them?
So in Germany, Rheinmetall, they've stepped up production. So they should be on, I think, 700,000 a year in about 2 years' time. But even still, that's, if you look at the amount being expended in Ukraine, that doesn't cover. If you look at parliamentary evidence in the Defence Select Committee, there's a kind of growing sense of panic that government and industry in Britain, private industry essentially, aren't working together effectively. So unlike Russia, which owns, you know, state-backed munitions factories and can just keep this constant production line going, in Western Europe, it's, you know, private companies, so the government has to give them a contract. The companies create a run of munitions, and then that's it. There's no kind of ongoing production line going. If you take a country like Finland, they've got a kind of national defence strategy where private industry and the state have a plan. They work together in the event of war. Everyone knows what they should be doing. Even, you know, a company like Ericsson, you know, senior executives at Ericsson also have a kind of wartime function. They have specific communications roles. They know in advance what that role is going to be, and they're in coordination with government about what they would do in the event of war. And that goes across industry, basically, in Finland and in other Nordic countries.
Let's play out the scenario then, because people will accuse us of fear-mongering or dramatising this. We're not saying that Russia is imminently going to invade the United Kingdom. The worry is that there could be some kind of NATO conflagration in the coming years, which would require British participation and where we can't meet our commitments. So detail that out for us.
The unspoken assumption is that Ukraine doesn't get the level of munitions and support that it requires to keep this kind of current war of attrition with Russia functioning. It runs out of men. The war is, you know, extremely costly in manpower. So on the current trajectory, unless things change for the better for Ukraine very quickly, Ukraine will probably be out of the fight 2025. Should that happen, then the fear is that Russia, after licking its wounds and rebuilding its army, would aim to kind of confront NATO on its eastern frontier with Russia, perhaps on the border Poland and Belarus, perhaps in the Baltics. If that happens, Britain has a commitment. By 2025, Britain is meant to be able to stand up an armoured division and be Britain's land component to the defence of Eastern Europe. It can't do that. The reality is that the army cannot do that.
There's this, a lot of talk that it's somehow emanating from Trump, this isolationist mood. Do you feel like it is all dependent on Trump, or is it going to happen anyway?
It's not all dependent on Trump. It is going to happen anyway. The US just is overstretched. You know, we can see even now it's bogged down in the Middle East. It's in terms of the resources it's donated to Ukraine. That itself has placed great stress on the US defense industrial base. What we do know is that there's a policy document going around Trump circles that talks about a dormant NATO, wherein basically the US, it doesn't withdraw from NATO, it doesn't close it down, it doesn't, you know, do anything officially dramatic to end the military alliance, but it forces Europe to basically take up the slack of defending.
So dormant NATO means a NATO with the US less interested, less involved, less prepared to fund it and back it.
Yeah, and you know, that is a perfectly rational and frankly fair assessment of how NATO has been allowed to kind of evolve over the past 30 years. You know, European countries haven't played their fair role. I think the thing to remember when people talk about, like, you know, countries, oh, you know, we're not meeting our NATO commitments, we're not spending 3% or whatever, it's framed in a way like, oh, you know, we're kind of letting the Americans down or whatever, you know, or in those terms. We should think of it as actually we've left ourselves defenseless. We've left ourselves completely America's charity, and essentially now the goodwill of Putin, which, you know, isn't something we can necessarily bank on.
That was Aris Roussinos. We're joined now by Elbridge Colby, who is a national security policy expert in the US. He served in the Trump administration, and he's become highly influential on the Republican side of American politics. In fact, he's very likely to get a big job, possibly leading foreign policy, if the Republicans win in November. In a way, he's almost the source of much of the anxiety here in Europe, because his main message has been that the US needs to focus on China, on the threat in the Pacific, and pull out resources from Ukraine, the Russia threat, and Europe. I started by asking him whether he thinks there is a real threat of a wider war on the European continent.
I think it's pretty grim. I don't think it's too much of an exaggeration to say that the risk of war is real. Look, I don't think that there's evidence that the Russians are sort of dead set on going all the way to the channel in the coming years, but I think they are building up a military over the coming years based on a sort of reinvigoration of their military industry at the cost of their civilian economy that will yield a probably more formidable military or at minimum, very significant formidable military that will pose a threat to Eastern NATO and possibly beyond, certainly in terms of the ability to strike out, beyond with missile assets and cyber attacks and so forth. And the fact is that Europe is manifestly unready for that situation, both in terms of standing forces, including, unfortunately, the United Kingdom, as well as the defense industrial base. And of course, as I've been trying to emphasize for a number of years, the United States is not in a position to kind of continue to play an overwhelming leading role in Europe at the same time as it's challenged in Asia, not to mention the Middle East. So I think, you know, prudence really dictates for Europe a greater degree of readiness.
So let's just take those two components individually. This idea of an industrial base that can actually support, we've seen in Ukraine how much the production of munitions and so on actually makes a difference. What's Europe's military industrial base at the moment? I mean, who actually produces weapons at the kind of scale we would need? And how does that need to change?
Well, unfortunately, that's probably China and Russia and maybe North Korea. So we're in pretty bad shape. Even the United States is not able to produce weapons for itself, let alone all its allies, at the sort of scale and rapidity that's necessary. And Europe's defense industrial base has really atrophied even beyond that of the United States over the last 35 years because of the peace dividend after the Cold War. The United Kingdom and France, I would say, are probably the leading defense industrial powers in Europe, but it's a far cry from what it was, let alone what it needs to be at this point. There is industry that can be built out, but it really needs to be reinvigorated and expanded.
Where are the sort of green shoots of hope in Europe? What would you be investing in? Are we talking Germany, the UK, Poland? Where? What could be expanded?
Well, I mean, my view, Freddie, and this is a little bit different than what you hear from a lot of Americans. Look, I mean, it's good from an American point of view for some money to be coming into our coffers, but often, you know, what money goes into that of the defense primes, the defense companies here, doesn't necessarily spread out to the American people. It's held by the shareholders who may or may not be American in all cases. But the more important point is that if we in the United States and if you in Europe are going to be spending or expecting you to spend significantly more money on your military in the future, it can't all be going to the United States. Obviously, that's going to be politically unsustainable. And also, I mean, there's a sort of gerbil through the boa constrictor problem, which is that there's a congestion in the American defense industrial base. So we all need to expand to meet the growing need. So what I'd say is, you know, certainly British defense industry, you know, the famous companies, the French as well, but also the Germans, because the Germans really need to be playing a much more significant part in both their standing military, but also the defense industry. Their companies like Rheinmetall, they used to produce at a much greater rate than they are now. But, you know, there's also Italian companies, the Poles are spending a lot. So I think it's going to have to be indigenized. You have companies like Saab, the Finns have companies, the Norwegians have companies.
Saab is now Chinese owned, however.
Well, that's a good point taken. I mean, but the, you know, the Chinese, the problem is that the Chinese, the Russians, and to some extent the Iranians and the North Koreans have a scale and capacity that we don't at this point. And I think what we've seen, Freddie, to your point from the Ukraine war, is it's just not enough to have a small number of exquisite capabilities. You need to be able to produce at scale.
Now, I don't want to stereotype the Germans. That's something that people are very sensitive about here in Europe. But they are good at building machines. And the car industry is embattled. It's threatened by the Chinese electric vehicles company. Do you think we should be thinking about repurposing the German car industry towards making tanks?
I think that's a very good idea. Look, here in the United States, I mean, I think one of the ways that you can get a political coalition together, my view, that doesn't just get an eye roll as a sort of Daddy Warbucks kind of argument that the hawks will always make and gets tuned out by the rest of the country, is to say, look, this is going to be part of a reindustrialization of the American economy. I would assume that there's be a similar reception, at least in the United Kingdom, given the financialization of the economy that I understand has happened over the years. You know, in the case of Germany, obviously they've retained their industrial capacity, but a lot of it is being challenged in large part for mercantilist reasons by China. So, I mean, I think, you know, defense industry, it's not enough to say we should, you know, repurpose our economy from a sort of, you know, development perspective to have defense industry, but we also have a security need. So I think together that should be a politically compelling argument, at least here and I would imagine in Europe.
If the US, as you have been strongly advocating for, withdraws somewhat from Europe and focuses its attention on the threat from Asia, there's going to be a window of at least 10, maybe more than 10 years, where Europe pretty much can't defend itself. What are we supposed to do during that period?
Well, look, and I don't want to be self-referential, but I think it's important to establish a little bit of credibility on this point, in the sense that I've been arguing about on this line, I would say for 5 years, maybe more than 5 years, with precisely the goal of trying to pull that to the left, you know, on the temporal scale, to try to get Europe to be more prepared. And for many years, these kind of pleas fell on deaf ears. And then you had the war in Ukraine, and now you have concerns about how the war is going and concerns about how the United States is going to react. Whoever wins the election in November of 2024, these concerns are going to be very real, because they reflect structural realities that are rooted in the rise of Chinese military power, and, you know, the constraints the United States faces with its own military, not to mention political resolve. So the best course of action for Europe is to get on it as quickly as possible. I think there's, you know, there is a time problem. There is a gap problem that is going to exist. Unfortunately, China's getting ready to move on Taiwan, or at least to have the option. I think we don't know what they're going to do. Nobody does. But within the coming years. So unfortunately, we are going to have to make the choice, and we have to make the choice for Asia. There can be some capacity for Europe, but it's going to have to be limited, as we've discussed before. I think the point here is a couple of things. One, yes, Europe can move, you know, may have to move slowly in certain ways, but also maybe this is a time to break through. I mean, the example of Operation Warp Speed in the United States, and I'm sure there are analogous examples in the case of Europe, where maybe you need to cut some red tape, maybe you need to cut some regulation or some political sacred cows, whatever they might be, to move faster to create that demand. The other thing is that, look, the Russians are formidable. They are going to be a more battle-hardened military. But A, they're much weaker than they were, you know, under Joseph Stalin or Nikita Khrushchev. B, they've suffered very significant losses in Ukraine. How much is up for debate? But, you know, they've lost a lot. And C, you know, this military is not going to be able to just roll through Europe and end up at the English Channel. I mean, the Poles, for instance, have built and are continuing to build a quite formidable military. I mean, the Finns have a formidable military. So we're not talking about, you know, we're not in 1939 in the case of Europe, where you're dealing with, you know, the most formidable military power in the world. It's a tractable problem. It's not even, I don't think it even requires what the Europeans had in 1988 during the Cold War. I think it's probably less than that. So it's a feasible goal.
What we've heard is this idea that 2026, 2027 kind of time is the most vulnerable moment where potentially there is activity in the Pacific that is taking American attention. And that's where potentially Vladimir Putin might think, right, I'm going to have a ding at NATO because Europe is exposed and undefended.
I think that's a very real problem. And it's made even worse by the fact that Vladimir Putin is now highly dependent on Xi Jinping in China. And also, you know, probably if anything has a personal leaning towards helping China and an animus against us in the West. So, you know, it could happen that way, Freddie. I'm actually even a little bit more concerned about the possibility that Xi Jinping might induce Putin to go first against NATO in some way to try to draw the Americans down even further into Europe and then deliver the knockout blow in Asia. But in any case, however it goes, I think the reality is going to be the same, which is that the United States must focus on the decisive theater. So I think this is a real problem, and we are going to have to face. I mean, you know, my view is just stepping back. You know, we have to get over the post-Cold War policies that we've been pursuing. I mean, I'm just struck, and I hear it, frankly, from a lot of British politicians. There's a real commitment to this sort of post-Cold War, you know, unipolar era, liberal imperialism kind of mindset. And I think we need to actually, if anything, go back to something closer to a Cold War mindset, which is to say, look, this thing could happen. We may need to, you know, adapt. The things that we had considered shibboleths and so forth may need to be re-examined, not because we want to do that, but because this is the parlous state of our defenses and the gravity of the threat.
But what you're saying will be very hard to hear for a lot of us here in Europe. I mean, you're someone who may well be closely involved in a future Republic administration. And what, at least what I'm hearing, is that if the US has to choose between engaging in Asia against China or defending Europe, you will choose Asia and leave us to our own devices.
We have to choose Asia. I mean, even we should, because Asia is, as Churchill put it, the decisive theater. I mean, he was talking about Europe then, but given the geopolitics and the economic map today, Asia is the primary theater and China is far more of a significant threat than Europe. So it's just logical and it's based on empirical evidence. And I think it's so compelling that any administration is going to have to follow it, hopefully by having the discipline to preserve our resources for that decisive theater, Asia, and ideally deter war or, if necessary, prevail in it. But even if we do get more enmeshed in Europe and the Middle East, which is what's happening now, unfortunately, that doesn't change the fundamental reality. So if the Chinese do move, and they're more likely to move if we're weak in Asia, we're still going to have to reorient. But in that position, we'll be doing so from a weaker and more willy-nilly perspective. What I would say to you, Freddie, is I claim to be a better friend to Europe, a better ally to Europe than all, than not all necessarily, but then so many of these Americans who go over and say, don't worry about anything. You know, just keep going on as if nothing has fundamentally changed. That is bad advice, and you can see how it's been bad advice even in the last couple of years over the Ukraine conflict, where a lot of people went to Europe and said, don't worry about anything, everything's going to be fine. And that's not what's happened, because the political situation in the United States has gone in the direction, frankly, that I anticipated. I don't want to be self-referential, but I think it's important to emphasize this point of credibility, which is, I think I'm speaking to Europeans as somebody who says, look, if you want to save this system, if you want to save the transatlantic alliance, it has to adapt. It has to become more equilibrated. It has to become, from a fairness perspective, yes, but more importantly, because of the constraints we face. And anybody who's saying that there doesn't need to be fundamental adaptation is not telling you the truth.
Final question for you, Elbridge. If it is Mr. Trump, do you think he would actually follow through with military action in Asia? Because he's someone who, as he says himself, likes a deal. He likes to find a quick solution to things. I could well see people like you, inside or outside administration, saying, okay, we need to engage, we need to defend Taiwan, this is worth committing troops on the ground for. And him saying, I think I prefer to do a deal and hand it over and carry on with a booming economy. Do you think that suspicion is outlandish?
President Trump has been very clear in saying that he's going to orient American policy on what's in the American people's interests. And he believes in peace through strength. And he has demonstrated in his first term the willingness to use force. He also says, I think he's willing to evaluate some of these shibboleths in a new light. And so, and he's made very clear that China is the top priority. And it was under his administration, his leadership, in which the United States turned towards a more, I think, rightly recognized China's confrontational approach and matched it accordingly. So I think the question would be, is it in the American people's interest? Is it in the rational interest? Of course, it has to be in the American people's interest to fight sometimes, but we don't want to fight. I mean, he, you know, as Senator Vance put it in his endorsement, the first senator to endorse him, he said he got us into no new wars. And President Trump has spoken about that. And I think I and many Americans say that's great. That's what we want. So we don't want wars. But on the other hand, if you're not prepared to fight any wars, you're going to get wars. So, you know, what exactly the circumstances are, I mean, his comments about Taiwan, for instance, are consistent with the American policy of strategic ambiguity, right? I mean, that is basically the United States has traditionally had a policy of ambiguity. So, I mean, I think that's, again, I'm not speaking for him, but when I look at what he says and his record, I think, yes, he's absolutely going to be prepared to use force in cases in which it's consistent with Americans' interests.
Elbridge Colby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
That was Elbridge Colby. Finally, we wanted to find a voice who could maybe pour a little bit of skepticism over this anxiety. There's always a risk of boys with tanks getting overly hot-headed at the possibility of war. Pippa Malmgren is a geopolitical strategist who is famous for focusing on the fronts that don't make it into the news. I started by asking her, how realistic does she think a hot war on European soil actually is?
So I think there's a huge difference between a Russian invasion and war. So I've argued we're already in war. We're already in World War III. We're already in conflict with both Russia and China. It's just been in technology and in locations where it's hard for the public to see it. So space, the high seas, the Arctic, and all of that's been relatively ignored by the press, either because it's not verifiable because so much of it is classified, or it's just too hard to get the story, or it's too technical. So things like cable cuts of significant internet cables underneath the oceans around the world. In a world where people think internet comes out of, you know, thin air, Wi-Fi is just there, they don't understand the connection between satellites and internet cables. So I think we're already in conflict, but it's occurring in those ways. Now we have a different question, which is there a possibility of an old-fashioned Ukraine-style invasion into a NATO country? I think the risk of that has definitely gone up, but the likelihood is still not very high. But the question is, why would that be smart for the Russians to even consider? And it might be they just want to provoke the West into taking steps that would justify them accelerating into nuclear threats. Now, we already have nuclear threats, which we take very seriously. But preparing for war doesn't help you very much when nuclear threats are on the table. So the question is, how do we de-escalate the nuclear threat? And then how do we avoid having Russia make a miscalculation to try to provoke that situation?
I mean, a miscalculation or a correct, albeit dark, strategic calculation. In one scenario that people have been talking about, focused on the potential years 26, 27, is that if, for example, the Americans are drawn into some conflict, hot conflict in the Pacific, there may be an attempt by Vladimir Putin to confront NATO in Europe while Europe is basically undefended. I mean, do you think that's a plausible scenario?
I think it's definitely a plausible scenario that China and Russia are now aligned, and they're aligned arguably both with Iran and North Korea. And so is there a possibility of collective action by any of those or all of them together that would leave the US and NATO having to face a multi-front challenge? And the answer is yes, we know this is the case. The question is how to prevent that from happening or how to manage it if it started to occur. And I think this is why the US and China in particular have been meeting at the level of Biden and Xi. They are trying to find a way out of this. It's not in China's interest to get into an old-fashioned military fight with the United States because, frankly, the U.S. is so much further advanced that China's possibility of success would be very, very low. However, using the threat of this possibility as a way of negotiating a better arrangement than we currently have between the U.S. and China does make sense. And let's remember that when President Putin has threatened nuclear weapons, President Xi has almost immediately come out and said, truce, constructive negotiations, talks, let's not go there. So China has an opportunity here to emerge as a peacemaker, even though it's part of a group that's being very noisy and confrontational.
How do you think the American political situation plays into this? Over here in Europe, there's an almost obsessive focus on Donald Trump. Once again, the idea is almost that the isolationist tendency emanates from him rather than anywhere else. Do you think that's true? Is he an isolationist? And if Trump is successful, do you think that's what we'll see? America pretty much pulling back in its world obligations?
I don't think that's an accurate portrayal. I think America is isolationist. And you can see this in various polls. You know, young people are the least willing in recorded history to become involved in any kind of confrontation or to join the military. They do not support engagement in Ukraine. There are many questions about engagement, even with Israel, which is a nation that normally the United States supports in full. And it's also true that this is both Democrats and Republicans. And it's not true that it's only Donald Trump. We also see Robert F. Kennedy, who hasn't been reported as much, but who is gaining traction remarkably quickly and widely. His approval ratings are the highest of any of the candidates. He's starting to out-fundraise his competitors. His profile is rising very, very quickly. What's interesting is even if he can't win the presidency, he is influencing the debate. And his position is aligned with Donald Trump, which is to ask the question, why are we in conflicts abroad when we have so many issues at home? And we shouldn't be leading with bullets, we should be leading with ideas. And so this isolationist tone from the United States is not only not just Donald Trump, but it's also not new. And we saw this for the last several presidencies. In fact, since George W. Bush, we've pretty much had every president retreating further into isolationism.
So your message is coming whether Trump wins or not. In which case, what is the message to European governments? I mean, there was some talk when I was talking to Mr. Colby that we need to get onto a war footing. He wants us to be, you know, we talked about repurposing German car factories to making tanks. I mean, how far do you think we should go? Do you think we're at an emergency?
Well, I do think it's hard to ignore it when we hear from senior NATO generals, commanders across different nations, Sweden, Belgium, These are not only Britain that are saying something is happening and we have to take this seriously. And we do have examples of Russia creating troubles in the Baltic, in the Baltic Sea, in the Arctic. These are all hints that this is a real possibility. On the other hand, to say that car factories should be making tanks is to be thinking as if we're in the 1940s, which we're not anymore. And modern technology is perfectly capable of managing these kinds of risks. We don't need to assume that war has to look like it does in Ukraine.
So what should we be investing in then, I guess, is the question, if not tanks?
It's what we are investing in, which is all kinds of high technology, much of it space-based, because satellites are the key to being able to manage anything that's happening on the ground. We see that already in Ukraine. That is basically a satellite-led war. So there are many, many options. But the question is, what are the diplomatic options that are being pursued? And how seriously are we taking this possibility? I think the thing is, everyone misjudged when Putin said he would go into Ukraine, and everyone said it was a bluff. And so it makes sense that this time there's a much higher degree of nervousness that he might follow through. And therefore, the issue is, how do you negotiate with China to put the pressure on him not to take a step like that? Remember, this has always been the Russian strategy under President Putin, which is called escalate to de-escalate, which is to make threats that are truly powerful in an attempt to force a negotiation to occur. And I guess that is the question for President Biden. But to date, he has staked his presidency on a number of key positions, and one of them is being tough on this issue. That has not been playing well with the American public, and it's not reaching any kind of deal with either Russia or China so far. So one maybe could consider the possibility that President Biden will start to change his approach as he realizes the threat is more serious.
Final question for you, Pippa. If it is President Trump again, do you think he will pull out of Europe to the degree that is being talked about? And secondly, if there is the Taiwan threat, do you think he will send American troops there, or do you think he will prefer to do a deal?
I think there is a real possibility that President Trump can win this election, and that has been massively underestimated by the press, but it's not a done deal. And I also think that whoever is the next president, it is unlikely that American citizens are going to be willing to go to defend Taiwan in terms of old-fashioned troops. They are probably willing to defend Taiwan in terms of strategic interest, which means having the Navy present, but not necessarily getting into hand-to-hand combat with China. I think we'd end up in some kind of negotiation process well before then. But I also think it's a huge assumption that China would do what Russia has done. And it's more likely that the Communist Party in China now is getting very uncomfortable with these war threats, putting pressure on President Xi to calm all that down and get back to the business of making money. And to do that, China needs to reestablish a better relationship with the United States. So I think we could bypass these old-fashioned risks of confrontation if we find a diplomatic pathway.
So you think pragmatism might win after all?
Absolutely, with China. But it's unclear whether pragmatism can win with Russia. And that's where we have to start paying attention to incidents that have already occurred that the press hasn't really reported on. Like, here's a small example for Britain. Recently, someone cut the main internet cable between the Shetland Islands in Scotland and the Faroe Islands of Denmark, which are off the coast of the United Kingdom. And nobody really cared because they were like, well, it's a bunch of sheep that live on these islands. But not understanding this is a critical point for assessing whether Russian nuclear weapons are present on nuclear submarines and ships. And so the cutting of that cable was indicative of the possibility that there are such weapons being deployed. And this is why the British press in particular needs to be better at reporting things that they have previously considered to be too obscure or too technical or too hard to explain to the British public, because they're all symptoms that the Russian threat maybe is real.
Pippa Malmgren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Pippa Malmgren. Thanks to her and to our other guests today. I don't know about you, but I'm left with the distinct impression that a major reckoning in Europe, at the very least, is just around the corner. Put that together with the rise of right-wing parties across the continent, and we're going to be in for a very different feeling few years. Thanks for tuning in. This was Unheard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.